Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by Ironman U, by EverySite.com, the hottest new technology around. RunCatalina.com, the Catalina Marathon coming up on Saturday, March 19th. Our Challenge Athletes Foundation, we've raised over $70 million to keep athletes in the game of life through sport. You can check out any of our interviews on iTunes or on Babbittville.com. We've had over 780,000 downloads of our interviews. Our next guest, one of our favorite guys. We're talking a guy who finished fourth at the Ironman, who's run a 218 marathon, and he's a best-selling author for his book, The Primal Blueprint, and his brand-new book, Primal Endurance, just coming out, Mr. Mark Sisson. Mark, how the heck are you?
I'm awesome, Bob. It's so great to talk to you again after what seems to be a long time.
It does, you know, and what's funny is, you think about it, we both got into this, well, you got into it earlier than I did, because take me back, were you a runner growing up? Was that your number one thing?
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking the other day, back in the late 60s, Bob.
No
way.
When
I started running, absolutely, with, you know, putting on my low-rise Converse sneakers and going out and jogging 3 miles in high school and then, you know, becoming a decent runner through high school and later on in college, and then the road racing in the mid 70s with the Aggie Running Club. That was my life for my first iteration as an athlete, was as a pure runner, ultimately becoming a marathoner.
So when you look back at what young Mark Sisson was doing in training back then, you ran, you know, again, 218 marathon, fourth at the Ironman. When you look back at that now, what would you have told that guy, based on the knowledge you have today?
It's such cliche, you know, if I'd known then what I know now. But the biggest thing I would have told myself was slow the F down.
Exactly.
Because, you know, we were going, we were redlining our bodies in those early days. And you gotta remember, this is, I don't know if you remember the name Jerry Lindgren, but,
of course,
you know, 250 miles a week,
yep,
of training. Some of the British guys that were setting world records were doing 200 plus. And so, you know, when Bill Rogers was running 138 miles a week average and I was only doing 119, I felt like a failure.
Right.
Well, you know, but I had my DNA profile done a year ago, and it came back and it reminded me that I'm only 59% endurance athlete and 41% strength athlete. So I wasn't a pure endurance athlete. So for me to extract a 218 out of that body,
yeah,
I got the most I possibly could have. But here's the big but. It cost me my career. My running ended at the age of 27 because I was burned out. I was injured. I was fried. I had all sorts of internal injuries and maladies. Irritable bowel syndrome. I had tendonitis, arthritis. I had all kinds of stuff from going too hard, from redlining too much. So I think the take-home story for me would have been that had I slowed it down, had I been smarter about my training, and when I say slow it down, we're going to talk about what that means, but had I done things more smartly, including the diet, by the way, and learned how to become a fat-burning beast and derive most of my energy while I was running from my stored body fat and not depending on Exceed and Gatorade and Gookinade, remember all this stuff?
All that stuff, right.
Yeah. Then I would have, my career would have probably lasted another 10 years if I wanted it to. I wouldn't have suffered from the joint problems that I have, you know, now at the age of 62 from having just gone too hard too long.
Was the fact that you're one of those, you're a real observant type of guy. You're watching from the outside as your body's breaking down. I'm guessing we're looking at yourself going, okay, I got to figure out why this is happening and how I can help the next guy so it doesn't happen to them.
Yeah, so I spent, you know, $30,000 on medical tests while I was starting to fall apart. As I was deteriorating, back in the days when I didn't have that much money, but I was just frustrated.
Right.
So I really kind of did dedicate the next part of my life to figuring out how I could be that strong, lean, fast, fit, happy, healthy athlete with the least amount of pain, suffering, sacrifice, discipline, and all the other stuff that we talk about. And the irony is there is a way to do this, and that's the essence of the book, Primal Endurance. It's really about how can I compete in endurance contests to the best of my possible ability, but without trashing my body, without ruining my relationships with my family or sacrificing my performance at work because of the amount of overtraining I'm doing. How can I do all this in the context of enjoying the pursuit and having it be pleasurable rather than just managing pain, which is what it used to be.
Right. And the misconception I think we all have, I remember in the early days of Ironman, that Thursday night carbo party, and it was, oh my God, you got to put as much carbohydrate in your body as you can because you're going to burn everything there is. And I used to feel like a slug on race day, but that was what we were all told you had to do. You had a carbo load. When did you start realizing that the fueling that you were doing and obviously all the rest of us were doing was just plain wrong?
Well, I started to realize it back in the late 80s when I hooked up with Johnny G, and I started training with Johnny G, and he was this crazy guy who was training for Ram, and
right.
He was eating 1,000 calories worth of avocado and olive oil on his bike trying to train his body to burn fat. And I thought, well, that guy's either crazy or he's a mad scientist. And it turned out he was a mad scientist. And so over the past 15 years, I've kind of rededicated my research into figuring out ways that we can minimize this glycogen depletion, not by adding more carbohydrate to our training regimen and figuring out how we can pack more grams of carbs in during a ride or during a race, but conversely, how we can become better at burning fat. And the way we do that is, as I've said in my original book, The Primal Blueprint, is by reprogramming our genes to derive most of our energy from our stored body fat. And that you do that simply by depriving your body, if you will, of the excessive amounts of carbohydrate that we used to think were required to put these miles in, and forcing your body to look to fat as its primary source of fuel at low levels of aerobic output, and then as you get better and better at it, deriving more and more of this energy from fat at even higher and higher levels of output. But there's a strategy in doing it. You can't just go in and say, oh, that sounds good, Mark. I'll cut my carbs out. I'll keep training like I was training, and I'll become a fat-burning beast. It doesn't work that way. There's a method to this madness, and that's really what we explain in the book.
What's fascinating to me, and I've always been one of those guys who back in the 80s when I was doing the Ironman and doing a lot of marathons, just thought, well, nutrition's really secondary. I don't have to worry about that. I'm burning it all off. I'm running all the time. I'm going out and doing these races that take 11, 12 hours. And then when you sort of stop doing that stuff, you're still sort of eating the same way. And then you look up a number of years later and you're 20 pounds heavier than you used to be. And you keep thinking, all I need to do is train for an Ironman or half Ironman again, and it'll go away. And when it doesn't, you think, oh, my metabolism's just slowed down with age. Do you deal with that a lot with a lot
all
of
the
people?
Time. Or you think, what am I doing wrong? Or you think, I have to put in more miles.
Right. That's exactly
and,
it. Yeah.
And it's a vicious cycle, and it's so frustrating to, Brad and I, when we're writing the book, we look at everything that's we look at starting line of the LA Marathon, and most of the people who are at the starting line, other than the elite 100, are overweight.
Yes,
they're
yeah.
carrying 10 or 12 or 20 or 40 extra pounds, and you go, dude, you're running 40 miles a week. How are you not slim? How are you not trim? Well,
right.
The answer is, you become so dependent on replenishing carbohydrate after every workout that you get into this vicious cycle where your brain thinks you've starved yourself of the only fuel it knows, because it only knows really how to burn mostly carbohydrate and a little bit of fat. So you tend to overeat the carbs. You tend to, carbo load every night now. And then, of course, you have to go out and burn it all off again the next day. But over time, these carbs, they increase your body's output of insulin, which is a nutrient storage hormone. You can get away with that when you're 20 or 25, but when you're 40 or 45, that's when you start to store that extra fat. And it becomes this vicious cycle that you can only break by becoming good at burning off your stored fat and relying less and less on glycogen or glucose that come from the carbohydrate in your diet.
So what do you tell people who go, listen, I'm working out, And what should I be eating? What should I be avoiding, and what should I be eating?
Well, you know, the sort of the obvious first couple of admonitions would be don't drink any drinks that have sugar in them, because a lot of people slam down 100 to 200 grams of sugar a day in just the drinks. And it may even be, you know, their so-called healthy green or fruity drinks that they buy at the health food store.
Right.
But, you know, keep away from those. Keep away from the other refined sugar-added foods. We try to tell people to stay away from refined grains.
Yes.
And in most cases, also whole grains. So, you know, what are you left with? Well, you're left with
tons.
Meat,
fruit,
fish,
vegetables.
Fowl, eggs,
yeah.
And lots of vegetables. So it's really, again, it goes back to our bodies are designed to function very efficiently on natural things that don't have a label on them, that weren't processed or made in a factory and using lots of, you know, artificial sugars and sweeteners and other stuff. And when you do eliminate the nasty stuff and come back to a real food diet, your body starts to recognize, this is how I was programmed at birth to start burning fat. You know, we're born with a factory setting that wants us to get most of our energy from fat. It's just the fact that we, you know, we're so exposed to carbohydrates so early in our lives, whether it's toast or Zwiebacks or oatmeal or pancakes for breakfast or cereal, or, you know, orange juice and all that. And next thing you know, we've taken away any requirement for our body to need to dip into its fat stores for energy, because we're constantly resupplying it with carbohydrates in the form of these sugars. So our true essence, our true nature is to be a fat-burning beast. We just have to get back to that if we want to succeed not only in being healthy, but in performing well on the race course. And back to your original statement about, you know, you are doing marathons and you gain weight. Well, if you're used to racing marathons at 161, and then 15 years later you're at 184,
yeah,
you're basically carrying a 23-pound backpack. Now, if you can, you know, guys pay $8,000 to shave 6 ounces off their bike,
right?
So if you can shave that backpack off your own body, you will de facto become faster and also healthier, by the way, and be able to maintain that speed or get faster on less work. It's because you don't need that vicious cycle anymore. You don't have to go get up and run or ride or swim every single day just to burn off the calories. Now, training for an endurance contest becomes, okay, strategically, where are my weak points, and how do I work on that? And so we find out that so many people are already, they're training too much, or they're in this, what we call the black hole of heart rates, where you're going just sub-threshold, and you can hold it for a while, and you can hold it for an hour some days, but over time, your body doesn't respond in any positive way. It doesn't get better at burning fat. It doesn't build capillaries. It doesn't do anything. It just sort of says, okay, you're beating me up. I can do it, but I have no reason to respond. So we tell people, all right, back it off a lot. So back it way back down to a heart rate when you're out doing your mostly aerobic stuff, a heart rate that you almost think is laughable. But that's where you start to develop the efficiency. So, you know, if you start out and you say, well, if you can tell me to run my long runs at a heart rate of 135, I'm only going to be doing 10-minute miles.
Right.
Well, that's okay for now, because if you do it long enough and you've dialed in the fat burning with a diet, pretty soon that 135 beat max is generating 8 minute per mile miles, and then maybe 7:30s. And you know what we saw and we detailed this in the book. Zach Bitter got to the point where he can run like 7 to 7:05 minute miles and derive 97% of his energy from fat.
Wow.
We used to think back in the 60s and 70s, we used to think that was impossible.
Right, yeah.
You know, but this is what these guys are doing now, and it's just, it's mind-blowing. So turns out the next level of breakthrough in human performance for endurance athletes will be from this ability to access fats, and having done so from manipulating a diet that is very low in carbohydrate and higher in healthy fats.
What I've noticed, basically adopting what you're talking about with the primal diet and just thinking to myself before I put anything in my mouth, it wasn't around a million years ago, don't eat it. It was amazing because I, as you mentioned, I went from 184 to 161 in the matter of about 16 weeks and went from 24% body fat to 16% without really a big change in my workouts. I thought I would have to work out a heck of a lot more. I was doing the exact same workouts and the weight just came off just by, if it's eating bananas, eating grass-fed beef. And there's nothing I'm not eating. I'm probably eating more than I ever ate in my life.
Yeah. The other thing, by the way, I'm sure you notice this, is your appetite starts to self-regulate.
It does.
And you're not as hungry as often, and you don't need to eat as much at any one meal to feel satisfied, because you become more efficient at extracting calories from your food. Now, in the old days, we would say, once again, well, why do you run, Bob? Well, I run because I like to eat, you know?
Right.
Well, what the hell, what's that about? I mean, you're running just so you can eat more food? How about if we took a thought experiment and we said, what's the least amount of food you can eat and maintain your weight and maintain your energy and not be hungry? And that's the key. And, you know, so it's totally sustainable. And this is one of the things that happens with this Primal Endurance program, is people's appetite starts to self-regulate. And they find that they can literally, some of these guys are doing triathlons, Ironman type events, essentially going into them without fasted, without having eaten a big breakfast that morning,
yep.
With drinking nothing more than water and maybe some electrolyte tablets during the course of the event until they get, you know, eight or nine hours in. It's amazing how when you tap into this ability the body has to access stored body fat and you unburden yourself of having to take in extraneous carbohydrate in the form of gels or drinks or bars or whatever else, much more efficient you are and how much faster you can go.
The other thing that was pointed out to me was the danger of salt. And there were, you know, we tend to be a nation that puts salt on everything. And especially as endurance athletes, we think, oh, my God, I got to have salt. I'm going to be racing in humid conditions. I have more salt, more salt. Do you see that as an issue?
See, when you dial the diet in, as we have, in the way that you've, you've experienced yourself,
yeah.
you don't need that much salt anymore.
Right.
And you don't have a taste for it. And just as the body tends to have an apostat that tells you when it's time to eat or when it's time to drink water, you know, our thirst mechanism works pretty well. We also have a mechanism that tells us if we need electrolytes. We sort of get a salt craving. Well, you don't get that as much when you eat this way because you don't really need that much salt. And the admonitions that we have from the medical community about reducing salt intake have much more to do with the fact that there's probably 2,500 milligrams of sodium in the processed foods that you're eating
yes.
every day
yep.
that you don't even taste as salt, but your body is taking it in as salt.
How have you changed your workouts? Through the book I was reading, you know, you do ultimate frisbee, you do slacklining, you do snowboarding. It seems like you mix up high intensity with, you know, some heavy weights in the gym. Talk a little bit about how you've changed over the years.
Yeah, so my main, if I had to pick one main low-level aerobic activity, it would be paddling. So I do stand-up paddling, and I'll do, you know, an hour and a half session sometimes, two-hour sessions. But again, it's pretty steady. I'm enjoying nature. I'm paddling with the dolphins.
Right.
I'm hanging out with friends. My heart rate is never high when I'm doing it. I might go for a hike and not a run anymore, because if I hike in the hills, it's just, you know, you can get your heart rate up fairly high and not too high. And then when I play ultimate, I'm sprinting all out, so I'm able to take advantage of my fitness, my innate fitness from all the other stuff that I do. I'm doing quite intense stuff in the gym, so I'll do squats. Heavy weighted squats now, maybe sometimes 400 or 500 pounds on a machine, but minimal reps. It's basically, we talk about in the book, this maximum sustained power concept, where if you're going to the gym just to hang out with your buddies and spend an hour and a half and fry yourself, I'm not going to judge that as bad or, you know, wrong, but I'm saying if you want to have fun and enjoy workouts, if you want to get more effective and faster and stronger, then there are ways to do this that don't involve this suffering and sacrifice and this grunting and groaning and this, you know, no pain, no gain mentality that we had for years and years. Sometimes if I'm going to do a leg workout, I'm in and out of the gym in like 17 minutes.
Yeah.
And I went deep. I went all in, but I only went for short bursts on a specific protocol, and then I left the gym basically refreshed. Whereas most guys would say, "Oh, wait a minute, leg day? Weren't you puking in a bucket for an hour afterwards?" Because aren't leg days the worst? Well, no, not if you do it the right way. And if the right way for me is to do leg days, so that I don't get injured when I play frisbee. The reason I do the work in the gym is so I can stay uninjured and fit enough to have fun. Because my goal, Bob, after being a veteran of 200 endurance contests in my lifetime, and you and I might have talked about this at one point, I said, you know, in all the contests I've been in, at no point from the time the gun went off until I crossed the finish line could I truly say, "Wow, this is fun."
That's where we differ.
Yeah. So, because I was, my ass was, you know, I was.
You were out there racing. You're racing
all
out. I was
out there. I was racing. I was competitive. I was at the front. I was,
right.
You know, and so it was always about pain management. Well, when I retired, I said, you know, I just want to dedicate the rest of my athletic career to having fun and finding pursuits that are fun. Now, when Primal Endurance, the book, came along, I said, well, there are a lot of people like Bob Babbitt who want to get into a race to have fun. Well, let me show you how to train so that you can have the fun in the race and derive the enjoyment from it and derive the enjoyment from the workouts without having it be this slugfest of pain management all the time. And that's really the essence of the book is, you know, how can we become this endurance athlete that we say we want to be? Because I would not take back one thing I did in the endurance community. I'm so proud of my achievements and the hard work that I put in there. But I'm telling you, I didn't have fun because I didn't know how to have fun. You know, it was just, it had to be about grueling. It had to be about, you know, I'm such a failure because I can't do 138 miles a week like Bill Rogers. I'm such a failure because I woke up today and I had a 15-miler scheduled and I don't feel like running it. You know, that was a terrible way to live my life. And I don't want that for anyone else. I want people to sort of have the benefit of my experience and my research and figure out how you can have everything in this regard.
What I've always told people is I've tried to promote the sport of triathlon over the years. It really is the fountain of youth, and it's something you can do even if you're not in great shape, right? Because if you're a little overweight, you can still do the swim, and you can still do the bike ride unless you're climbing some major mountain. And the run is always the challenge. And for a lot of us, especially as we age with knees and ankles and everything else we're dealing with, it's how do you run less but still be able to, you know, do triathlons and be successful at it. And obviously, it seems to me the key is you do more high-intensity running, but you do less of those running workouts so that you can still go to the starting line on race day.
Yeah, I mean, when you get to be our age and you've been yep. doing this for decades,
yep.
Dude, your body knows how to run. You know, you're just going to go out and do it again and again and again every day and sort of all you're going to do is beat yourself up. Your body knows how to ride the bike. So if you can pick out those little nuggets of workouts that are real specific to making the day that you show up at the starting line count for everything, your body will know what to do. If you've done the base work, if you've done that sort of low-intensity stuff, your cardiac function is at its peak, you've learned how to burn fats, your body knows how to do that, you've trained in the gym so you know how to sustain your form, because that's really what falls apart at the end of a race isn't, you know, how many Ironmans have you finished or marathons where you're out of breath, right? Never.
Right, never, right, yeah.
Because it's the muscles that fall apart first. So how do we train the muscles to sustain that power over that period of time? That's what we're doing in this primal endurance strategy is we're kind of breaking the race down into its component parts so that you're able to do that without having to go out and practice the damn thing every single day of your training.
The other thing that I like in your when you talk about that the key is to be inconsistent. We've always, as endurance athletes, have said the key is consistency. You want to do the same workouts every week so that way you can judge them. And in this day and age with everything that we have out there in terms of Spartan Race, Tough Mudder, Warrior Dash, Color Run, Triathlon, Marathons, 5Ks, there's so many endurance options out there. I bet you really like the fact that there are options out there that aren't the most competitive in the world, but give people an opportunity just to sort of showcase their wares and get out there and be an endurance person.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, the concept of the book here is I want you to be prepared for life. I want you to be able to get into any kind of endurance contest and be competitive.
Right.
Just based on the fact that you are a well-rounded athlete. You're not just a skinny-ass marathoner or a fat-ass marathoner, you know, who only trains who only trains for marathon and nothing else, and God forbid you should get into a pickup game of basketball where you have to, you know, make a move or you know, juke somebody. No, I want people to be as well-rounded in their fitness as possible. So that's why, like, I play Ultimate, and I'm, you know, Brad will tell you this, because I smoked him the last time we played. He was guarding me man-to-man. Mike, I sprint faster now at 62, dude, than when I was a marathoner. Because I've trained it now for the last 10 years. I've trained in that context. Now, I can't run, you know, I can't run a 29.55 10K anymore, but I suspect if I get into a 10K tomorrow, I would come in my age group in the 62, you know, in the 60-64 category without having run literally more than 5 miles a week for the last 10 years.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I feel the same way. I try to race triathlons as much as possible, and I feel I'm more competitive now than I was, obviously, before I got rid of the double bowling balls.
Yeah, yeah.
That made a difference.
No, but don't you like the fact, just knowing deep down, that you beat a couple of guys who trained their ass off for this event?
Totally.
And you didn't train at all. You were just, you know, you just knew how to be fit and knew, sort of you, I hate the word hacking it, but you sort of hacked the concept. And that's really what I'm looking for, is a sort of all-around fitness. Like, oh, you know what? There is a 10K in the Pacific Palisades tomorrow. I think I'm going to go hop in that, you know, and be able to do that on a whim, and not as opposed to 12 weeks until the Palisades 10K. Better start my blended training program now.
Yeah. So your goal, change the lives of 10 million people. And that led when you started Mark's Daily Apple. Talk a little bit about that. And I mean, that's most people's goal is, hey, I want to do a triathlon, I want to do a marathon, I want to change the lives of 10 million people. And so that's a hell of a goal.
Dude, well, you're raising $70 million for
Foundation.
I mean, that's a hell of a goal. So, you know, what is it, 20 years ago? How many years ago did
it's,
you start?
It's 22, yeah.
Yeah, and did you sit down and go, yeah, you know, in a few years, I'm going to be talking about having raised $70 million?
No, we hope that we'd be able to give Jim McLaren a van he could drive with his hands, and that was it.
Bingo. So I'm saying, so when I sat down and said I want to change the lives of 10 million people, I think I missed the zero, because I think we're closing in on that figure.
Wow. You
know, Mark's Daily Apple has 2 million unique hits a month, three unique visitors. You know, we've published 25 books now in the sort of ancestral health realm. 8 of them are under my name, but some are by other authors.
Yeah.
You know, we're introducing, you know, we started a food business this year. We've got this Primal Kitchen mayonnaise. It's taken off across the country. It's a mayonnaise based on avocado oil and organic eggs. So I feel like, you know, this truly is my life's work. You know, I had my time as a coach, and I was with ITU for a while. I've been in other businesses, but man, just to have the kind of traction that we've gotten with this Primal Blueprint, and you're an example. You know, you come to me and you say, dude, I picked up the book, and it looked like something I could do. It looks sustainable, and I've lost 23 pounds, and I feel better than I've had in the last 10 years. We hear that so many times. So I know this technology works. I know it's changing lives. You know, our big leverage point right now is to get the medical community to embrace it more than they have, because they're a little leery of me telling them, you know what, to get really healthy, you have to eat more fat and work out less.
Well, and also you look at what you see on TV, and you've got, you know, P90X and all these other great programs, which are awesome. But when the number one thing is you got to get your nutrition in order before you do any of that type of stuff. Because otherwise you're going in there 20 pounds overweight doing a high-intensity workout, and you hurt yourself.
The biggest frustration I have is with people I see at the gym. And they're on the treadmill, and they're, God bless their little hearts, they're burning 400, 450 calories of workout per day. And they still have the same 25 pounds to lose that they've had in the 6 years I've been watching them go to the gym.
Right.
And it's like, there's something's wrong with that picture. So 80%, you say 90, I say 80% of your body composition is determined by how you eat, how you rearrange your body's energy compartmentalization so that you derive most of your energy from stored body fat. And when you do that, when you are able to burn fat efficiently, you trend toward your ideal body composition without even working out. Yeah, you have to work out, of course, I say that.
Sure.
But really, diet is most of it.
It really is. The other thing that I noticed when I was training before is everything was, oh, I just had this great run. Let's go get a, you know, a bagel with cheese, and you know, yep. you reward yourself. Long
yeah.
bike ride, I'll have a couple Cokes, I'll have this, I'll have that. And basically you've just reversed everything good that you did during the workout.
That's pretty much true. One of the other things that happens as a result of being good at burning fat is, and it, I notice this, I work out better fasted. So I get up in the morning, I've been doing this for a long time. I wake up in the morning, I have a cup of coffee. About 10 o'clock, I go to the gym and I do a workout, so I haven't eaten all day.
Yep.
I'll do an intense workout, or I'll go for a hike or whatever. I'll come home, I won't eat because I'm not hungry, because I'm still burning fat and I'm still good at it. And then around 12:30 or 1, I'll have my first meal of the day. And there's this power, this empowerment that comes from being able to go long periods of time without being hungry and still not losing your energy and, you know, having
right.
your, you know, everything works fine. You maintain your muscle mass and it all works great, but so different from the old days of, you know, I got to better have a pre-workout drink and then a post-workout drink and then, you know, or otherwise I'll cannibalize my muscle tissue. That just doesn't happen when you learn how to burn fat. This whole paradigm shifts when you've trained, you know, in a particular way that maximizes your fat burning as an athlete, and that you've eaten in a certain way that throughout the rest of the day just provides this unlimited supply of energy, and doesn't require you to have to think, oh my God, it's noon, I better eat lunch or I won't make the meeting this afternoon. You know, it's just very empowering.
40 million people with type 2 diabetes, one-third of Americans are morbidly obese. As I've been traveling, I did a lot of travel this year, and just really noticed it more than ever when you're in the airport, and everybody you see is, you know, 10, 15, 20 pounds, if not more, overweight. And you just don't know, how do you get to these people? How do you reach the masses with this message?
You know, that's been a real challenge for me over the last 10 years that I've been doing Mark's Daily Apple.
Yeah.
And I think it's a grassroots kind of thing, and it's one person at a time. It's somebody coming up to you and going, Bob, you look better than I've seen you in decades. What are you doing?
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
I mean, that's how it happens. And
right.
then, because that's a pretty visceral response. You know, somebody coming up and saying, you know, you're a little overweight and I think I can help you. People don't react well to that.
No, you're right. Because you go, I mean, and this, you can wear baggy shirts and you wear a sport jacket and you can pretty much cover up 10 to 15 without much problem.
Yep.
So, Mark's Daily Apple. If people want to check that out, it's a blog. Is that all this on your website?
Yeah. MarksDailyApple.com.
Okay.
The book is, of course, Primal Endurance is available on Amazon. It's coming out. It's for sale as of January 4th. But you can also order it on our site directly. And so that's MarksDailyApple.com, or you can go to PrimalBlueprint.com, which is our e-commerce site, where the book is for sale as well. So, well, we have a lot of free information. You can download a 92-page free ebook called Primal Blueprint Fitness as your first visit to Mark's Daily Apple. Millions of people have gone there. We have hundreds of thousands of user experiences and testimonials of people who have embraced this way of eating and this way of exercising and swear by it and think this is. I mean, the key testimonial we get, Bob, isn't. We get a lot of these, like, oh, Mark, I lost 50 or 75 pounds. I'm off my meds. I feel great. The single best testimony we get is, I feel like I can live this way for the rest of my life. I feel like a weight has been lifted off my shoulder because I don't have to think about 30-day segments of dieting. And this is a very sustainable way of living.
You know, that's exactly the point that hit me. It didn't take me more than a week to realize, you know what, I was worried, okay, if I travel, it's going to be a problem. I'm at the airport, there's hard-boiled egg, there's celery, there's carrots. You can always find a salad with chicken or whatever it happens to be. You can find good options. It's just the fact that you're mentally ready for those good options.
Exactly. And, it's, you know, it doesn't have to be grass-fed beef.
No.
Free-range chicken every meal. You know, you obviously want to kind of trend toward those in the rest of your life that you can control. But when you're on the road, it's a joke for me. I'm on the road. I always find something to eat. I have a challenge to anybody. I can go into any restaurant in the world and find something that I can eat that's going to fit my plan. Even if I have to go to the waiter and go, look, go back and talk to your chef and see if he can put some carne asada with a little bit of guacamole, you know, and a sprig of cilantro, and I'll be good.
Exactly. Simple.
You can always do that.
So LGN, look good naked. That's a huge motivator.
Well, for a lot of people, it's a huge motivator. Ironically, most people come to Mark's Daily Apple because they are just at their wit's end, because they've been frustrated by trying
everything.
Yeah. And a lot of these people have come to me because they've been Googling, diabetes, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, or some of the things that really put the fear of God in them. So a lot of people come to Mark's Daily Apple, first and foremost, to get their health back in order.
Right.
And a particular side benefit of that is looking good naked. And that's ultimately what a lot of people will say. You know, I really came here for the health, but the fact that I look good naked is pretty damn cool. But it really, you know, the main thing is I'm off my meds. I feel like I'm going to live a lot longer. I have these amazing stories about people who have transformed not only their life, but their spouse, their kids, and everybody's all on board with the program now. And they're, you know, fixing meals together. They're hiking together. They're doing all this stuff that modern families just don't do because they're off doing fast food, and then they're on their mobile devices, not paying attention to each other. So there's a lot going on here with this particular way of eating and living and exercising that is beneficial in all aspects of life, not just looking good naked.
You know, I think it's not going to be that long down the line, like in New York when they outlawed large soft drinks, right? They outlawed soft drinks in the schools. I think down the line they're going to be looking at the level of obesity in these commercials that basically say, hey, when you buy one pizza, you get a second pizza, plus breadsticks, plus a 64-ounce drink, plus a large cookie. I mean, you're talking that's about as unhealthy as a family can ever be, and that's something that's encouraged through mass media.
Yeah, and it's encouraged because our brains are still hardwired to seek those things out. Now, you have to kind of override that natural tendency that our brain has to look for salty, sugary, you know, fatty, crunchy, whatever the stuff that big food builds into these processed meals. They're appealing to something in us that drives us to part with our money to buy these big bags of potato chips and these, you know, whatever else that's unhealthy. So there's a level of education and awareness that must take place, and that's my job with Mark's Daily Apple and with the Primal Blueprint and with Primal Endurance. My job is primarily as an educator. So I just want people to understand, look, I'm not going to judge your life choices, the decisions you make, but I am going to tell you that some of those decisions are likely to manifest themselves in you gaining weight, in you getting arthritis, in you not being able to move well, you know, in you not living as long and being depressed and moody. What if I gave you an alternative that you could try out? And if it works, then you get to decide. And that's kind of how do we transform the world? We do it one person at a time.
Yeah.
You know, who tries it, who sees the results, who's able to transmit that information to the rest of their family and get everybody else on board. And that's pretty much all we can ask is that people really, you know, understand the information and make intelligent decisions that not only serve them in the short term, because they give them some amount of pleasure, but serve them in the long term because they don't increase their risk for dying.
The other aspect that I think is really important, maximum results, minimum effort. And I think that's the thing that sticks in people's minds who have never been an endurance athlete and look at it as somebody who's an uber athlete who's spending 30, 40 hours a week doing this to get that fitness. And is that something that people come back to you surprised that, wait a second, I didn't put in that much effort and I've gotten pretty good results?
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, you know Sammy Ankinen, right?
Yes.
Okay, so Sammy's a good example of a guy who he dialed this in pretty early, and he got into the Primal Blueprint and the paleo way of eating and training. And the more he got in, the more he said, he was sort of saying, okay, I'm really going to test this. I'm going to see if I can train for Ironman on 11 hours a week, you know, in the old days. And he wins his age group, and he goes 8:48 or whatever it was on a high-fat diet with minimal training. You know, there's a good example of a guy. Now, to be sure, he had a decade of
base. Exactly. He's a great athlete to begin with. Yeah.
Great. But the fact that he could then take all that previous work and build on it by doing less work and by just being strategic about how he ate and how he trained. And that's really, look, we live in an age where everybody else is looking for instant gratification.
In other words, better results with less work.
Right.
Why not in this arena of endurance contests?
Well, and especially with how complicated and busy the lives are now, you have less time to do this type of thing. So, Mark, if you had one athlete from all these years who, or not so much an athlete, but one person who epitomized the, I don't know what I'm doing here, I'm grasping my last straw, help me. Tell me that one story that moved you to obviously continue what you're doing today.
Well, so I have a guy, his name is Larry, and he was grossly overweight. Larry's probably 5'8", and I think he's well over 300 pounds.
Oh, wow.
Had terribly bad health. His wife was not that well. His kids were not that well. And Larry is a smart guy. He reads a lot, and he does the research. And when he finally came across the Primal Blueprint, he said, this makes sense from a science point of view. I'm going to do it. He lost 150 pounds.
Wow.
He got down to 165 pounds. And, you know, you think, well, that's kind of cool. I see that on Biggest Loser all the time. No, but it's been 5 years now. He's sustained it.
Lifestyle.
He got his wife to the point where she now is her ideal body composition, and she was overweight. His kids are exceptionally fit now. He's living the life. He's so into it now that he's basically an advocate for it wherever he goes. And that's the kind of person that I see as the real leverage and the real strength here, a guy who took what was going to be a very slippery downhill slope for the rest of his life. I mean, he was in serious, serious health issues, completely reversed it to the point that not only does he look great and does he speak eloquently about it, but he's a guy who at the age of 50 is looking to improve for the next two decades.
Right.
In other words, he's not going, oh, well, you know, that was good, but now as long as I can stem the decline, I'll be okay. You know, I can't let it go downhill too fast. No, he's a guy who's going, I'm going to continue to improve because I see the power of this. And so he's like we have, not to belittle anything about what I just said about Larry, because we have thousands and thousands of those kinds of stories. But he's one that always sticks in my heart, because whenever I go to the message boards, there's Larry saying, oh, this is incredible, and let me help you, you know.
The part that I see a lot is usually you see an overweight guy with an overweight girl, or you see a fit guy with a fit girl. I think it's very difficult for one person to make that lifestyle change without buy-in from their significant other.
That's a huge issue for a lot of people.
I think it is. Yeah.
We've had I've talked to men and women who have said, I tried it, I can't do it because my wife won't. She's not on board, and I need her to cook. Or she's giving me grief because I'm doing this crazy new diet program. It is important to have your significant other or some support group, whether it's a friend or somebody, get in. It's not impossible without it, but it makes it a whole lot easier if there's buy-in with them too.
So the other thing, obviously, you and I met through the sport of triathlon, and you were instrumental in those early days of creating what now is USA Triathlon, and triathlon becoming an Olympic sport for the first time in 2000. What are some of your memories from those days of the challenges of taking this sport that had to really give up its soul, which was drafting, right? The whole thing of you don't sit behind another bike, but to get into the Olympics, we basically had to become a different sport to get into the Olympics.
Yeah, I'm pretty much the guy that drove that.
You did, I know. And I remember you and I had knocked down dragouts, but you were right. You were totally right. We never would have gotten in without that.
You know, I feel good about that. I'm proud of that. It was a very painful part of my life because I took heat from. You were good natured about it, and we had that. It was more of a philosophical
discussion. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But there were people who basically sent me hate mail.
Wow.
It was uncomfortable in that regard. But I knew it was the right thing to do, and as did, by the way, most of the other board members of the International Triathlon Union. And the rest, as they say, is history. And I think it worked out very well. So I'm thrilled with that. There's sort of two things I want to be remembered for in triathlon.
Yes.
One of them is that, and the other is the brick.
Creating the brick workout?
Yeah. Naming it the brick. I didn't create the workout because other people had done it, but Zagarino and I gave it the name, and that's part of the lore.
Well, and for a lot of our listeners who don't know the history, the triathlon throughout the 80s and the late 70s was a non-drafting, you'd not sit behind another person on a bicycle. And I remember, I think it was the 88 World Championships, maybe up in Canada or somewhere, where all of a sudden, you know, you have Mike Pigg as your overwhelming favorite, and this is, you know, wetsuits were now part of the game, and everybody came out of the water together, and it became one of those things where they were so close together they couldn't get away on the bike. And we sort of, as we are thinking about potentially becoming an Olympic sport, in your mind, you're thinking, this is going to come down to officials deciding who's your Olympic gold medalist, and nobody wanted that.
So my first official act as the executive director of Tri-Fed USA in 1989 was to go to Hilton Head. And do you remember that event?
That was when the wind was so bad, or the waves were so bad, they had to switch the swim around or something?
No, that was where we had to disqualify.
Oh, the top three people, and Lewis Murphy won the race. Yes.
That's right, Lewis Murphy won the race. Because I had to stand in front of the ESPN cameras who had just filmed this race and
right.
tell them, your film is no good. Did anybody get Lewis crossing the finish line? Because he's the official winner of the race. And that was the first time I said, hey, this just isn't going to work if we're going to have...
I did not realize that, because I tell people that all the time when they say, well, why is it draft legal? And I tell them that, you know, we had the USTS National Championship, and so a lot of the media had covered the top three guys and left. And then later found out after their stories ran the next day, oh, by the way, the fourth place guy who nobody has photos of, he's the national champion.
That's exactly right.
Oh, that is funny. So I'm assuming, did you go to the first Olympic triathlon in 2000?
Absolutely. Are you kidding me?
I know. You had to be there, right?
Had to be there, yep. Yep, and was there for Athens in 2004. No, those are great, great times.
Being there for that first triathlon, and people forget that when triathlon came into the games, and mountain biking had come in 96, beach volleyball had come in 96, I don't think the Olympics really moved a needle for those sports as much as they did for triathlon. And I think when triathlon came in, the producer of the show for NBC, Lisa Lax, had been producing the Ironman, loved the sport of triathlon, decided to showcase the sport of triathlon in Sydney, do basically a postcard from Sydney with the triathlon. So Sydney Opera House, and crowds were, you know, McKeely Jones to this day tells me that she couldn't hear. Her ears were ringing for days because the crowds were that huge. When you saw our little sport being showcased on the Olympic stage for the first time, what was going through your mind?
Oh, are you kidding me? It was such a proud moment because so many of us had worked so hard for no pay, and again, in the midst of some significant political opposition because of this drafting thing.
Yes.
So to kind of have it come together and to have the race be so photogenic and to have that, and have Simon, who's my friend.
Simon Whitfield, yes.
You know, win for the men, and in a you know, basically a photo finish kind of event. It was, you couldn't have scripted it any better. 200,000 people lining the course as spectators. Great coverage on television. Yeah, it was certainly the epitome of my involvement in the sport as an administrator by far.
So what I find is interesting over the years, you know, how a lot of us looked at the Olympic races and, you know, you'd see these guys running 29 minutes off the bike and be like, okay, so they're basically swimming, doing a cruise, and then they're running fast. And who knows if they're even measuring these run courses. So, right? And, you know, sort of like there was the Ironman, which was the real sport, and then there was this Olympic thing, which was sort of, these guys aren't real. Well, then McKeely Jones gets a silver in 2000 and then wins the Ironman in 2006. And then Jan Frodeno, who won the gold in 2008 from Germany, just won the Ironman World Championship. So now... that's where all the great Ironman athletes are coming from. They're coming from that Olympic format. Even though it's draft legal, they are riding their butts off. It's a different game than it was in the early days.
It needed to mature. There was that assumption that everybody's going to sit up in the ride and just, and coast through the 40K of the ride and then run their butts off. And so there was the pure cyclists had a problem with that concept. But over the years, it became clear that you had to ride strategically. You had to ride hard. It became incumbent upon the race directors to put together courses that challenged the athletes, of course. But that's exactly right. Now you see that the ITU has become a breeding ground for future Ironman champions. And you have to say a lot of that's based on the quality of work that they were doing for so many years.
Yes.
In those events that enable them to apply that. You know, just like in marathoning, you know, most of the great marathoners.
Start out 5K, absolutely.
5K, 10K, you
know.
Gabby Selassie and so on. So, we're seeing that in the sport of triathlon now as well. So, I think it's all worked out for the better with this draft legal thing. It couldn't have gone any other way. There was no way to take 50 guys who are really good swimmers and then say, all right, separate yourselves out of the bike, you know.
Right.
Well,
it's funny because I've been talking to the guys from Spartan Race who want to get into the Olympics. And in their races, I don't know if you've seen any of them on TV, but if you miss an obstacle, you have to do 30 burpees. Right.
Yep.
So imagine that as an Olympic sport while they have somebody judging burpees. And I'm like, guys, this ain't going to work. We got to get rid of drafting. You're going to have to take a look at this burpee thing because it ain't happening in the Olympics.
I still don't know how they judge kipping pull-ups, by the way. But
No. Yeah. it's pretty fascinating. So, Mark, when you think back, running in the 60s, becoming an elite runner, getting into triathlon was a teeny little sport, finishing fourth at the Ironman and, like you said, over 200 endurance events over the years. Now you're still in that arena. New book, again, Primal Endurance. When you look back at that journey, how do you evaluate all that's happened in your life?
So, it's again, a cliche, but I wouldn't change a thing because what I've done with Primal Endurance is I've taken all my mistakes,
yes,
and all the things I've learned, and I've put them into an easily digestible book form so that anybody who picks up this book can go, wow, this looks like a great way of achieving the kind of results that I want to achieve without the pain and struggle and suffering and sacrifice that poor bastard had to go through his whole life. And, you know, I needed to go through that struggle and sacrifice. I needed to get injured. I needed to become ill in order to be so pissed off at the system to start to do the research. I've been doing this for 30 years, Bob. I mean, I've been researching and writing about training and fitness and health and diet and everything else for 30 years now. And it took that sort of a impetus of my being, you know, so frustrated and pissed off that I'd done this to myself by following the conventional wisdom and following what other people had done, that wouldn't have happened. You know, I wouldn't have gotten to this point had I not had those challenges. So I would not change a thing. I really wouldn't.
Love it. Mark Sisson has been our guest again. The book is called Primal Endurance, Become a Fat Burning Beast. Mark, what's the website for people to check out, to potentially buy the book, but also to check out Mark's Daily Apple?
So go to Amazon.com to order the book. You can go to PrimalBlueprint.com to get it directly from us. We appreciate that. And also go to MarksDailyApple.com, which is my daily blog. 4,262 articles over the past 10 years.
Oh, my God.
One a day.
Wow.
And then some. A wonderful opportunity for people to get, you know, started and dig deeply into this way of eating and way of living.
And from personal experience for our listeners out there, I swear to God, started in late July and went from 184 to 161, went from 24% body fat to 16% body fat, went from 44 pounds of fat in my body to 24 pounds just by not really changing a lot in my exercise, but changing the way I eat. So think about everything you're putting in your body. Definitely check out Primal Endurance. There's nobody who knows more about not just endurance, but to keep you as an endurance athlete forever. That's the whole idea. Again, we are brought to you by Ironman U, by EveryCycle.com, the coolest new technology around, RunCatalina.com, our Challenge Athletes Foundation. We've raised over $70 million to keep athletes in the game of life through sport, Babbittville.com, and our iTunes channel. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.